Welcome to Language as Purpose. I'm Eureka Foster. Posta Eureka desu. I've found happiness and purpose in learning and using Japanese. And here I'm speaking with people who use their passion for text or use their language skills in their work. And I think that that's what really helps other people engage with the wider world, their expertise. So I want you to hear how my guests are helping us be open to what we don't know and about how language can highlight our human qualities, especially in this technology-reliant world. So today I'm speaking with art expert, dealer, and lecturer Max Rutherston, a specialist in Japanese works of art. Thank you for joining us from London today, Max.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
First off, I'm eager to speak with you as the art world encompasses a lot of things where language can come into play. So that's everything from producing, commissioning, preserving, you know, buying and selling, promoting art. But in particular with you, your knowledge spans multiple countries and languages. You've facilitated exhibitions and fairs on an international scale, and you also advise your own private clientele. And you are known as a specialist of Japanese art. So naturally, I would say, well, why did you choose, you know, Japanese and this language space to work within? But I'm extra curious in your case because I had read that you went into Japanese after years at auction house Sotheby's, working in 19th and 20th century European and Russian pictures, impressionist and modernist, modern paintings. And then you were a dealer in modern British pictures. So could you make us a bit aware of what surrounded you beforehand, before you switched to the Japanese space?
Oh, yes. If I can bore you a little with my biography, I started as a student of languages. And I was fortunate enough to start learning French when I was 6 years old. My parents both spoke good French, and they used the language when they didn't want the kids to understand what they were saying. And I've always thought that it wasn't so much that I wanted to understand what they were saying, but I thought it was very adult to be able to speak another language, and particularly French. And as a family, we used to go there fairly frequently. So I got French under my belt quite early on. When I was 13 years old, I changed school and I had an opportunity to take another language. And the choices there were Italian, Spanish, German, and Russian. And I looked at the first three and thought, well, I can catch up with those anytime, but Russian is the interesting one. So I went for Russian, and in a way, the rest is history. I followed my taste for those two languages through school. I did well at them. And so I went on to university. I went to Oxford and read modern languages, Russian and French, and Russian and French literature. Now, because up to then, all I had done was to pursue my love of language, I hadn't really thought about what I was going to do as a career.
Sure.
And it was only when I left Oxford, or in the year before I left Oxford, that I had to think about what I was going to do next. And that led to some panic and some dilemmas.
As many people have felt, yes.
Absolutely. But, I ended up doing a year's course or a nine-month course at Sotheby's, during the course of which I decided that what I wanted to be was an art dealer. Now, I had some background. This wasn't pure accident.
Sure, yeah.
I had been involved in the arts, and I had worked in two commercial art galleries before I even went to university. But the important point to make is that I had no art history background. I happily landed this very good job at Sotheby's. I landed one of the best jobs in the company, Impressionist and Modern Pictures. And although I had to learn the skills of the job, and eventually I did learn those. But language really already from very early on stood me in very, very good stead. The fact that I spoke good French, fluent French actually at the time, really meant that I could converse with clients in that language. And that's continued to be the case, right? I've learned other languages since, but French has always been a very, very strong card in my pack, to the extent that I would say that in what I do day to day now, dealing in Japanese art, I've had the greatest success in finding art to sell finding collections to sell in France. And it's not only, I mean, you know, of course, you know, it's been a huge help to me that I speak the language and it has allowed me to converse quite often with collectors who don't speak English or speak very little English. I think the other part of it is not just communication. It's somehow the fact that I speak their language gives them confidence in me.
Sure.
The sort of real test of that was once when I was competing for a collection. I was in direct competition for a French collection, or a small part of a French collection, with a French-born dealer. And I knew throughout the negotiations that the collector was inclined to go with a Frenchman because he was French, and I had to keep on bringing new arguments into it. And eventually, I'm pleased to say, I won the collection. But I don't believe that I would have even been in that race at all if it hadn't been for my French. And then I had to use, you know, my other skills to persuade the guy. But I was particularly proud of winning that through being able to communicate.
I suppose that also, in addition, because you know more than French, you know, you know other Romance languages, that perhaps some of your other clients can speak on your behalf, you know, if there is the sort of competition going on, or people can recommend you.
In that particular case, when I realized that I was still not winning the battle, I went to a Belgian client who is, you know, he speaks English, Flemish, and French, and I got write a testimonial, and it was that testimonial in French that swayed that particular collector to go with me.
Well, that's nice to hear. I always call that the human element, right? It's your expertise and your dedication. People see that, and you know, it flows through. For people that maybe don't know much about Japanese art, I think a lot of people automatically, because of what they see in film or TV, they think, you know, swords, sometimes sculpture, metalwork, maybe even masks. You are an expert in netsuke. So for the benefit of our listeners who might not know what netsuke is, could you briefly define it for us? Give us a sense of the surrounding art.
You're right to ask, because quite often even Japanese don't know what netsuke is. So
there's a slight dilemma there.
In the Edo period, so broadly speaking between 1600 and 1868, Japan was a closed society. You know, it didn't really communicate with the outside world, it was in some senses it was a police state, and there were various laws, particularly and notably sumptuary laws, which dictated what merchants or what anyone could wear. And you know, merchants were who held the wealth, but ironically didn't hold a particularly high position in society, were prevented from wearing showy clothes. So you're a super wealthy merchant in Edo, Japan, could not wear the equivalent of Versace shirts. So the solution to this, you know, wealthy people always want to show their status and their taste. And they got around this by wearing such things as medicine boxes and money pouches from their belt, supported by these carvings, netsuke. Now, in the early stages, probably in the 17th century, run through this very quickly, these were probably very simple buttons, to put it. You know, they were pieces of amber, maybe a nice piece of ivory, a section of narwhal tusk, something like that. But during the course of the 18th century, increasingly, they were carvings, figure of carvings, of people and of zodiac animals and mythical animals, mythical legendary figures, whatever. And those carvings became more and more sophisticated, reaching their zenith, I would say, at the end of the 18th century. And it is those carvings that I deem in.
Well, you just said, you know, zodiac animals, and that brings to mind, especially when we're talking about language and culture, perhaps Westerners are not aware of how much animals come into play when it comes to, you know, folk tales or kind of the mystical nature in some Asian storytelling. So as far as Netsuke, I believe, you know, you would see everything from monkeys to foxes to, you know, what do you see the most of, especially in your own stock or in your portfolio?
The zodiac animals, the 12 animals of the zodiac are prominent, but you then get other funny animals. One good instance, I think, is a frog. And you might well ask, well, you know, why a frog? It's not a zodiac animal, but the Japanese like word
play.
And the word for frog in Japanese is kairu. And as you well know, return is kairu. Therefore, you made a gift of a frog Netsuke to people who were leaving because it was a token which encouraged them to return.
Lovely. I would also like to ask you with regard to your switching to Japanese, not entirely, I realize you still use your expertise in other languages, but there are people also who will say, it's too late in my career, right, to switch to a new region of concentration, or I'm too old to learn another language. What is your response to that kind of statement?
Well, first of all, in the linguistic context, and I, you know, this interview is
particularly
about language. I think that language is a little bit like swimming. And lots of people, those people who have never had the opportunity to try and learn a foreign language are frightened of it. They don't think they can do it. It's like somebody who has never been in water will think they can't swim. And so, you know, my advantage was to learn French or to start learning French when I was very young, when I was six. And that is the easiest time in life to learn a language. So when I was 13, I had the opportunity to learn Russian. And I chose Russian, which was the most difficult of those. And first of all, I didn't have the fear of learning it. I had the belief that I could learn it. And I did, which meant that later on when I came to learn some Italian and some German, again, I had no fear. But all of that happened, you know, before I was about 21, 22.
Which is why you hear often, right, put the kids, immerse them as young as possible, starting at three, and so forth.
Yeah, but the younger you learn a language, the easier it is. But apart from anything else, you know, the actual, the organs of language, you know, the tongue, the way we use our mouth, our tongue, our teeth, all of that, all of those are much more flexible to learning new shapes and new ways of behaving when we're younger. Now, after a certain age, I can't remember what the age is, but they say that, you know, but it is much more
difficult. Thank you for pointing that out. I was not thinking about that.
But you know, it gets harder and harder physically to make the right shapes of you know, of the lips, or, you know, to get the right breath, whatever it is, to produce a correct sound. So mimicking, and there is a lot of acting involved, I think, in speaking a language well. I'm a good mimic, to the extent that, you know, I found myself in Italy earlier this year talking to a receptionist in a hotel, and he thought I was Italian. Now, that was absurd because my Italian is not that good, but my pronunciation is good because I'm a good mimic. So for the few words and things that I said, they came out well enough to convince him that I was Italian. But had we got into some philosophical or complicated discussion, I would have broken down.
It went right over your head.
That bit, I thought it's hilarious that he thought I was Italian, but, you know, I can sort of understand why. There's no doubt that the younger you learn language, the better. So in my case, you know, it was curious that I had this opportunity when I was 38 years old to learn Japanese. Wow. It is far, far harder, not just for the reasons that I spoke about just before, but the other thing is that memory obviously becomes weaker. Actually, learning new grammar, learning new vocabulary, all becomes harder the older you get. But nonetheless, at 38, I still believe that I could learn a language and learn a non-European, non-Romance language. And, you know, I did. I was happy enough to. I was really very fortunate because Sotheby's, who employed me, put me through a one-year course, which was 6 months at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies in London. an intensive course in the Japanese language, 4 days a week in class, you know, and lots of homework.
I think that's the only way for an Asian language. Yeah, really.
It was a serious commitment. So 6 months in London, 3 months in Japan, 3 months back in London. You don't learn a language as complicated as Japanese in a year. It was really because I subsequently met my wife, who was Japanese, who spoke very little English, and the fact that I was doing business in Japanese, you know, meant that I've reached a tolerable level of proficiency in the Japanese language. But of course, what I haven't done, and people who don't know about Asian languages may not understand this, but it's what I don't really do is write the language. So I can speak it tolerably well, I can understand it tolerably well, I can get by in it, I can certainly do business in it, but I can hardly write it at all. And my reading skills are pretty weak.
Well, even while you were learning, you were definitely able to communicate enough with your wife, right? And you kind of probably grew in your communication with each other through that. But that also reminds me, learning a language or multiple languages, it does force you to think about how you communicate about yourself, how you're presenting yourself to someone. So, I imagine that even if it's a later start in life to learning a particular language, as long as you have the mental determination, you have a goal, and you want to also improve how you come across, or, you know, you have a mission that you want to serve, then you can do it. You can absolutely do it.
If I wanted to impress anything on our audience today, it would be, if you have an interest in a language, believe in yourself. It's a painful process. There's no doubt about that. One of the terrible things I think about learning a language is that there are periods when you can feel that you're improving, and then you reach a plateau. It's like a staircase with very, very long tread. As you go up a step and you feel you're progressing, and then you go along for a very, very long time. And that is that horizontal period can be really depressing.
It's sort of plateauing where you're just trying to, you can't go any higher just yet.
You don't think you're making any progress at all. And then suddenly, from nowhere, you go up another step.
But hey, that happens in sports. That happens in anything, right? You hit a wall or you plateau, and then as long as you keep working on the technique and then you let go maybe and you learn to relax a bit, you'll graduate to the next level.
Another thing I'd like to get across to anyone who's, beyond unfamiliar with learning languages, I very clearly, when I went to live in France as a student, when I was 20 years old, at that stage, I had had a really, really good education in the French language. So on paper, I could write really good French. I could read a lot of French. I probably had a vocabulary that was richer than a French kid of my age. And probably a better knowledge of grammar. But I didn't have conversational French. So I spent my whole, the early days there, I spent preparing sentences in my head before opening my mouth. Now, that is not the way that language operates. And the one thing another thing I'd really like to get across to anyone listening for this is you have to be prepared with a foreign language to make mistakes. Because actually, conversation, communication is far more important than correct grammar. Now, I'm not saying that people shouldn't strive to have correct grammar. Of course they should. But the first purpose of language is communication. And therefore, you have to be prepared to open your mouth and say the things you want to say or make mistakes along the way. Because interestingly, we most of us never think about this, but we often start a sentence in our own language and change halfway along. So essentially, we make grammatical mistakes, but we sort of plow through them and come out at the other end having expressed.
There's no other way.
But people shouldn't be frightened of doing that in a foreign language, because actually daring to try and say things, even if you get them wrong along the way, is an important part of learning that language.
And also being confident within yourself, right?
And yeah, but I do think, everyone should strive to improve in the language that they know. And also, I think that do think that pronunciation is very, very important. So you should try to learn from listening to other people. And that's what I was talking about earlier on about mimicry. Anyone who is unable to mimic someone else, even in their own language, already has a great advantage. To be able to reproduce from your own mouth what you're hearing is a great gift. I mean, anyone who has that is very fortunate.
Yeah. I mean, I know when I've tutored people, whether it's in Japanese or English, you know, I always make sure and reiterate there's a reason why people say watch films or go to YouTube videos, you know, when you're trying to learn a language, because you want to hear people in your industry, in your field or in your social circle, how they're talking in that other language. And often film and TV, it's really kind of special, actually, because if you watch, for example, older Japanese films, you're also listening to older Japanese that currently people in Japan don't even speak that way, especially if you take samurai films, for example. So thank you for that. Do you yourself do anything specific or extra outside of your daily work to practice your ease of working within Japanese or any of the Romance languages? I read that you've lectured in Russian, Italian, and French, I believe. But in lecturing, I would think you're using the same words over and over if it's a professional lecture and you're talking about your portfolio. And I think maybe the problem-solving part of your advisory service is what forces you to consider different wording. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think I would have to admit that there is a difference in my fluency between the languages you've mentioned. So I have lectured in French. When I lecture, I prefer not to have a written text. If I'm using what I like to do is to have a PowerPoint, pictures come up, I know what the pictures are, and they just act as my prompts to give an impromptu lecture. So the wording can be different from one lecture to the next. It's never entirely the same lecture. There's no prepared text. I've done the same in French. So, you know, my French is good enough that I'm really comfortable in doing that. And in fact, I prefer to do it because I think a lecture that is not read is always much more interesting than one that's read.
Yes, indeed. It's pretty boring watching somebody read off the screen.
I will not read a lecture in English, and I will not in French. Well, I would prefer not to in French. But I'm afraid that my Italian is not good enough to do it impromptu. So the one time I gave a lecture in Italian, it was written. And the one time I gave a lecture in Russian, it was written. And, you know, I read. So there's no other way of doing it.
Well, you did what you had to do, right, to get the information across. What about your sort of advisory service? Is that where you kind of, I don't know, maybe encounter new wording based on the given problem or?
No.
I don't want to say problem. Advisory can also be a very good thing.
I think consultancy in my field is, you know, it's largely about the things that I deal in, and therefore the language, the sort of, you know, the specialist language is familiar territory to them.
I'd love to hear if there's been a situation that you can tell me about where your language expertise or your work has helped someone with their mental health even, or just help them re-examine their understanding of a given country or culture, maybe made them more open. Is there something that's happened that you can speak to like that?
I can't think of an instance of that.
I did read an online review of someone who had worked with you, and it was particularly lovely. They said, "There are few whose integrity would match that of Max Rutherston LTD, and none who would surpass it."
Oh, really?
Which is a pretty outstanding compliment. But I imagine, once again, in this kind of advisory service, you may not know, is it right? You may not know the person before they come to you. So you may not know the reasons why they might be inquiring about something or selling something, whether it's just an evaluation question or a cultural question. Do you have hope personally that you are helping someone discover something, if not something about themselves or their family history?
Well, I suppose, you know, the most of the advice that I'm giving is about purchasing works of art, whether it's from me or from an auction or from somebody else. It's a little bit difficult if it's from a competitor, because then you could say you have a vested interest. But I try just as much as possible to give people good advice, because I think ultimately, you know, if the advice is sound, you impress people, and you know, sooner or later they come back to you. So.
Sure. Well, I'd love to hear any thoughts you might have on the point of learning languages today in this current environment. There are many, at least in the U.S., there are more and more kids today growing up here who are speaking one or more languages, whether they're growing up with it at home or, especially in New York, you see little kids all the time learning different languages and, you know, in pre-K, kindergarten. I would like to think there's a lot that kids can do with their language skills later on. And I love to encourage people to keep going, adults as well, who are trying to learn a new language. But there are people who say, you don't need it, right? You have a phone. Our machines are getting better. Generative AI is reaching further and further, and you don't need to learn another language. And then, of course, there are people who don't even, you know, want to travel or to learn about another culture. But in terms of this assumption that people don't, they shouldn't need to learn languages anymore, I was thinking in terms of the art world and technology. I read all these concerns about looted art, the provenance of certain items, law enforcement saying AI can analyze these vast amounts of data to identify patterns between artworks for tracing purposes. Interpol has an ID art app where users can compare their own photos of objects to their database. What would you say to people who are trying to learn languages today to encourage them to keep learning? You know, what help does a human specialist, not a machine, bring to the art world? For me, I think it's storytelling, but would love to hear your thoughts.
It's a very apposite question, because we're at a crossroads with AI. You know, I've seen some text produced by AI, which is quite, you know, pretty extraordinary. But the existence of AI, I don't think, negates anything that you and I believe in. Because I do think that language is about personal enrichment and one's personal engagement with other people and other cultures. I mean, you know, it's the key to getting on with people, and the key to understanding their cultures, and the key to literature. There are great translations from great literature, but nothing can replace reading a great novel in the original text. Nothing. So, you know, I think the role of the translation is to give those people who are not lucky enough to be able to read in that language an opportunity to have a glimpse of what it's like, but it's not the same thing. So, you know, however sophisticated AI gets, I don't think that individuals should give up on language.
Well, I also think I agree with that. And I also think someone in your position, the more years of experience you have, not just in a field, but also speaking with people within that field, you have a wider network of contacts to discuss issues or ask questions of. And in the art world in particular, I think of sort of these legacy families, you know, that have the collections to loan museums or to give collections. You have history coming from missionaries, all these stories that you can tell. And the AI, of course, has to be fed, right? So hopefully the human specialists working in the art world have stories that maybe would not be told otherwise unless they were the ones telling them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, conversations between people are, you know, they're immediate. They're spontaneous. Words come out just like, you know, it's a
to and fro.
Breathing.
It happens automatically. I was just in Turkey, and Turkish is a language I don't have. I struggle to
learn a few words.
I've heard it's very harsh.
We met this very charming taxi driver. He had no English. And so he was saying things into his phone in Turkish, and they were coming up in text on his phone, and I was saying things back to him. Well, you know, that allowed us to have an exchange of sorts, but I'm sorry, it is not the same as communicating directly with people. So to sort of say, well, there's AI that can do all this translating for us. Well, yes, in a sense it can, but that's not the same as speaking spontaneously from the heart directly to people. You sort of have to wait while the machine does the translation. It's not the same as speaking directly to people.
Sure. I don't know what it's like right now in the UK because I am not living there, but in terms of one's living environment here in the US, there are many concerns about cuts in funding or outright elimination, which can keep people from learning about other cultures or belief systems. We have libraries experiencing cuts. We have book bans because people don't agree with the content. We have language studies being cut from academic institutions. If this were to happen more amongst people you know in your field, or even if auction houses started cutting their language programs and expected people working for them to fund their own education if they were going to work in a specific department, you know, how would appreciators of art, how would their attitudes change if that were to keep happening? And I guess that the larger question is, why is it important for any of us to even make the effort, right, to learn another language? Because that's kind of what it feels like. There are folks who are saying, I really don't need to leave my environment that I know to get uncomfortable, to make mistakes and learn something. And I don't need to learn about other cultures. Why?
I think one should take that discussion away from the art sector, perhaps, and say, well, what happens in politics if people don't speak to each other? You don't engage with other cultures. You don't understand them anymore. And that's when you're in real danger of going to war with them. You know, we need the people. Look at a country like Iran. We need people who speak Parsi, understand the culture, to be, you know, engaging with people there, so that bit by bit the sort of enmity between the West and Iran disappears.
I think in especially in
isolation,
yeah, and in the art world, as you've proved, I would think. If you can work in multiple languages, as you said at the top, this sort of trust factor, which we see in diplomacy and politics and business and any kind of negotiation, right? If you don't have the trust factor, the agreement will not be signed. The negotiation will not end, you know, well.
Interesting. You know, I would argue, let's take the relationship between the US and China, which is, you know, important. In a pretty delicate state at the moment. If you had, you know, it's probably rarely been the case that anybody really senior in the States or in the UK, for that matter, has spoken Mandarin Chinese. But you can imagine a situation in which future President Trump actually spoke Mandarin Chinese. You know, it would make a huge difference to the relationship.
Well, just sitting down at a table and hearing someone casually say something in your language makes you feel better, puts you at ease right away.
Of course, you know, presidents have extremely able advisors and interpreters, but and those interpreters could be extremely important as well if they really know the culture.
Absolutely. Or if they know the political leader, if they spend 24 hours a day with that leader representing them.
Having the right people in place in that context can be very important. But it would be a marvelous world in which, you know, presidents too.
I mean, I don't know all the languages you know, but I was happy just going to your website because you had the language, you know, buttons at the top. I know that's not your translation, but you have this virtual Netscape marketplace on your
on your website with a little section where you say, you know, since the pandemic and with the importance of international trade, right, it helps to have this kind of marketplace that you've created. Is there anything else that you can think of that has surprised you in some way, or just even confirmed what you thought at the beginning, learning these different languages and then kind of making a switch to Japanese in terms of whether how it's helped you grow in your understanding of someone, how it's helped you kind of maneuver through similar cultures, even in conversation or in negotiating with other people?
Specific, except that, you know, just as I was speaking about French and how, you know, my being able to converse in French has produced a lot of business. It really had. But I could say also, you know, it's the situation has changed with the war in Ukraine. But I used to have a lot of Russian clients and a lot of Ukrainian clients. You know, regrettably, Ukrainians can't really buy for obvious reasons, and the Russians shouldn't be buying, and I have no interest in selling to them at the present time. But nonetheless, you know, most of my Russian clients, a good number of them, spoke English, but and knew my competitors. But the mere fact I could speak to them in Russian, which we didn't necessarily do all the time, but it just gave them the sense that I understood their culture, and therefore understood them. And it did mean that I had very close bonds with these people. I mean, you know, there were some clients who spoke no English, and therefore the fact of my speaking Russian really put me in a very superior.
Is he sure? Absolutely.
Even with the ones who spoke English, I would say that I was in a stronger position than my competitors because a bond was made by my, I don't think it was just linguistic. As I say, we would often, you know, the majority of our speaking may have, or our conversations may have been in English, but they understood that I understood their culture. And so they could, you know, that creates bonds. I was with a friend the last week she's had a very complicated upbringing. She's of Russian Armenian background. Family lived in Iran and then also Germany, and she subsequently lived in Switzerland. So she speaks Russian, French, German, English, and Farsi. And when she's speaking, we tend to speak in French, but we can speak in Russian, but she tends to sort of skip between languages, and she'll say a word, she can't think of a word in the language she's speaking, she'd say it in another. And she just said to me, and it was very touching, she said, you know, you're one of the few people that I can do this with, because you've had a sort of similar, although we don't have a total match of languages, but she said, you know, I can be saying these things, not find the word, and just say it in another language, and you understand instantly, and that makes her feel very comfortable.
Sure. And I don't think there's anything better, right? Especially if the person across from you is suffering, or if they're lost on the street and they can't read English and they're confused, that moment where you can step in and say, let me help you. I'd be happy to help you.
Yeah. It was funny. I was in a doctor's surgery, actually an accident, an emergency.
Are you okay? How long ago was this? Okay.
I had a heart scare. It was absolutely fine. But I was in this surgery, and there was a Ukrainian guy, well, a Russian speaker in there. This is in London. There was a Russian speaker in there, and I started chatting to him. It turned out that he was Ukrainian. He spoke no English. And so, you know, I was just chatting to him to sort of keep him happy, sort of thing. And had he gone for his consultation and not found, you know, not being able to express himself, I would happily have stood in and helped to interpret. But it so happened that the Indian doctor who was on call that day was speaking to him in Russian. I mean, how weird is that?
No, but again, that just speaks to, right, the comfort, the familiarity, that human element, that kindness can come through.
For the Ukrainian, it must have been a huge relief.
Sure.
You know, they express his you know, what's wrong with him and his worries and, you know, whatever, and found the right doctor for the job.
Now that's wonderful to hear. Well,
I thank you very much for your time today, Max. I hope I didn't take too much of your time, but it was lovely to chat with you.
Thank you.
Today's episode was recorded at AT1 Studio here in New York. I'm your host, Eureka Foster.
これからもどうぞよろしくお願いいたします。ありがとうございました。
さようなら。